And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon. For some, meat production, slaughter, and consumption is a scourge. Others demand plentiful quantities of cheap beef, pork, and chicken. But that isn't our focus today, however. It's how meat has had such a big influence on America. We're with historian and author Maureen Ogle. Her latest book is In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. And Maureen Ogle joins us from Ames, Iowa, where perhaps the temperature may reach 0 degrees today. Welcome to you, Maureen. Good to hear from you again.
It's nice to talk to you again, Joe. Thanks very much for having me. And it is actually like a, I don't know, 5 above 0 right
now. Oh,
all right. We're happy.
Well, good to have you with us, Maureen.
Thanks.
Let's begin by establishing where the U.S. rates in meat consumption compared to the rest of the world, and if any other nation even comes close to what we consume.
According to a widely distributed report about a year ago that first appeared in The Economist and was based on some U.N. figures, the only country in the world that has a slightly higher rate than the U.S. is Luxembourg. Don't ask me to explain that because I can't. But no, Americans eat somewhere, it depends on what set of figures you use, but somewhere in the vicinity of about 225 pounds of meat a year, and that's way more than pretty much everybody. The Danes, for example, Denmark is an enormous meat production country. They only eat about 55 pounds a year. So, yeah.
So how do we account for that?
We Americans like meat, and we have had a sense of entitlement to it that dates back to the colonial period. It's not exactly bred in our DNA, but close to it. Americans for 4 centuries have believed that to be an American was to have lots and lots of meat.
So when did it become de rigueur to have meat with each meal, breakfast, lunch, dinner?
According to eyewitness accounts from the colonial period, during the colonial period, what happened when people came from Europe to North America was that their great culture shock that they experienced was abundance of land. In Europe, of course, is very small. England is very small, and the overwhelming majority of people in those places in the old world in the 17th century rarely ate meat at all. But when settlers came to North America, there was no reason whatsoever for them to not eat meat, and there was every reason to eat meat, since keeping, for example, at least a cow on hand was a way of actually accumulating wealth. So from the colonial period, Americans were eating an enormous quantity of meat that visitors from abroad were always startled by.
What were Native Americans' eating habits, beef eating habits?
They
Buffalo.
Didn't. Yeah. There actually were bison on the East Coast as recently as the 16th and 17th century, although those were eradicated fairly early on. But the Native Americans along the eastern seaboard kept no domestic animals at all, and that, in the eyes of the Europeans who encountered them, damned those Indians forever and ever. Even William Bradford said point blank, "You are not entitled to use the land because you don't practice agriculture. You don't have farms, you don't plow fields, and above all, you don't keep domestic livestock. We do. That's a mark of civilization."
But didn't they grow other things?
Oh, yes. Yes, they definitely, Native Americans were definitely carnivores. There's no doubt about that. But they did not keep any domestic domestic livestock with them, except dogs, which, as near as anybody can tell, they did not eat. But yes, they planted crops, plenty of crops, but they hunted the meat that they ate. They didn't keep livestock.
So should we move along to the 18th century and what happened? We'll skip right through the colonial period. What happened in the 18th century?
In the 18th century, one thing that I found fascinating when I was researching this book was that from almost day one, the people who settled, the colonists, were engaged in a global economy, and in particular...
I'm sorry, I just realized I meant the 19th, but anyway...
Okay, all right, yeah, because there is actually something sort of interesting about that. But the 19th century, that's really where I... that's actually where the book really gets going, because in the 19th century, Americans who already had this well-developed sense of meat also had to confront a new problem of sorts, and that was that, rather to their own surprise, Americans were demonstrating a preference for living in cities rather than on farms. And that, and you know, we're also used to living in cities now. Something like 90% of us live in cities in the United States. We don't really stop to think about the fact that city folks don't make their food. So the bigger the urban population, the bigger the burden on whatever farmers there are. And in this case, in the 19th century, Americans built literally a continent-wide infrastructure for raising livestock and shipping, at the time, live animals from various places in what is now the Midwest and the Far West to the cities that were mostly congregated along the eastern seaboard. And building that infrastructure, in effect, created an enormous commercial livestock and meat slaughter industry.
What about the lore of the West and the so-called romance of the cowboy and the big cattle drives? Did that have any effect on consumption?
No. Well, it only had effect on consumption in that all of that emerged simply to serve what was already an enormous demand. And I think our perception today of the meat industry is somehow that we're being, urged to eat meat by the industries. What I found when I was researching was that the livestock and meat production industry in the United States were definitely driven by demand. By consumer demand. Consumers in America, urban consumers, are extremely fussy about what they want. They want cheap food, and they want a lot of it, and that's especially true of meat. So this meat industry that emerged was existed to serve demand in any way, shape, or form. So all of that Western lore was, you know, it just didn't sort of happen in a vacuum. And I should also add, I was, again, a little surprised by this. I didn't know that much about it. It was a very short-lived period. The whole thing with cowboys and the romance of the range and all that stuff, it was highly commercial, extremely well-organized. Much of it was run by corporations and what were called syndicates. It was less romantic than it was hardcore capitalism in action aimed at satisfying demand.
Tell us more about Armour and Swift, who were two people, actually,
yes.
And not the companies, but and what they did to really change meat processing and distribution in the United States.
Again, this was, when I started this book, I would tell people what I was writing about, and they would proceed to tell me, oh, these nasty, evil corporations did X, Y, and Z and really ruined local farming. And research proved otherwise. I'll just mention Gus Swift because he was the first person to do this successfully. As I mentioned earlier, in the 19th century, Americans built this infrastructure to ship primarily live animals from places like Chicago, Kansas City, St. Louis, to eastern cities where the animals were actually slaughtered. Swift started out as a cattle buyer working in Massachusetts, and he was frustrated by how much of his profit went to pay the middlemen who were, in effect, gobbling costs to move that live animal. So he took him and his family to Chicago with the intention of trading cattle. He didn't go there because he wanted to build a meatpacking plant. But once he got there, he realized that there were other people who had already experimented with technologies for shipping fresh meat instead of a live animal, which was far more cost-efficient and eliminated a host of middlemen. So he developed an enormous nationwide system that involved things like warehouses, ice depots. He had to find retailers. He had to find wholesalers on the East Coast. He had to build the plant. He had to buy railroad cars. And the reason we know his name and that he became very, very wealthy is that he built this system that allowed him to slaughter animals close to where they were raised and then only ship the meat. And in the process of doing that, he and then Philip Armour, a few years later in the 1880s, completely overturned this relatively ancient system of shipping live animals. I was stunned at how quickly, literally 200 years of industry got overturned in the space of about a decade. It was quite remarkable.
And what about the effect of refrigeration?
Well, that again, there was another thing that I have a PhD in history, and my degree was in the history of technology, so I'd been taught in graduate school that Gus Swift invented the refrigerator car. I found out when I wrote my book about beer that that was not true. Americans had been using refrigerated rail cars with, that are literally stocked with ice. This is not mechanical cooling. These are cars that are designed to hold lots and lots of ice. And there were hundreds and hundreds of patents on those. And Swift bought, he tinkered around and found the most efficient design, and then he purchased that patent from the inventor. So he didn't invent a refrigerator rail car. It was already in use. As you can imagine, it would have to be, since Americans were living in a very large geographical area with most of the urban population at the time centered on the East Coast. So somebody had to figure out how to move all that food, say, from California to the East Coast.
Maureen Ogle, you just mentioned your book on the history of beer in America, but you also wrote a book on the history of home plumbing.
I did, yeah, yes, and I.
It's something we don't want to do without.
No, and you interviewed me 12 years ago because I had wrote the book about Key West. Yeah. Yes, and there is a connection between and among those books, believe it or not.
Well, we are speaking with Maureen Ogle. She is an author and historian, and her latest book is In Meat We Trust: An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. On today's Topical Currents, let's take a short break, and we'll rejoin the conversation.
And we're back 19 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Maureen, did you say that that interview on the Key West book was 12 years ago?
I believe it was.
Oh my
we're
God.
Both probably, well, I'm gray now. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
I'm interested to know, I don't want to get to this issue yet, but I want to know if there's been any decline in meat consumption per capita in recent years. With more knowledge of the industry and the advent of more vegan and vegetarian choices, local food movement and all that, has there been a decline at all?
No.
No.
That's the short, simple answer. No, there has not been. No. Americans tend to what economists call substitute. If they're interested in health, they'll stop eating beef in favor of poultry, which is why poultry is the number one meat seller in America these days and has been for about 30 years. But no, consumption vacillates from year to year, but over the long haul, no, it has not dropped.
Well, on this subject, Jeff writes, you said that Americans consume around 225 pounds of meat a year. At 365 days a year, that equals 9.6 ounces per day per person. Does that sound right to you based on your own diet and that of people you know? Sounds pretty high to me.
My own diet is off the bell curve. In fact, when I found out that Americans ate, two things. I found out that Americans eat a lot of meat, and given that some people are vegetarians and some people are like me and eat very little meat, that means somebody out there is eating a lot of meat. And remember, that's per capita, so it's also including children. When I got toward the end of finishing the book, I decided to keep track of how much meat I eat, just because I figured at some point someone would ask me. I consume about 25 pounds of meat a year. So to me, I actually can't figure out who's eating 225 pounds a year, if you want to know the truth.
Yeah, that's a lot of meat. How much meat do we supply to the rest of the world, and how does it differ from our own meat supply?
I'm going to dredge those statistics up out of my mind. I believe that somewhere around 20 to 25% of the meats produced in this country, not the livestock, but the meats, raw meats, fresh meat, is what gets exported. But that number does not count things like, packages of frozen chicken pot pie or, cans of beef stew. That's only fresh meat that's actually being, except it's frozen, shipped abroad. So it's a significant piece of the market, and it has been since the colonial period. It's not the only source of outlets, obviously, but yeah, exports are a pretty big deal if you're a farmer.
What about developing nations like China and what's going on in China? And did you find that it's always true that as a nation develops, meat consumption rises?
Yes, that is true. And within a society, as individual incomes rise, people start, again, substituting. They'll eat more meat as their incomes go up. Now, there's going to be a cap on that. Bill Gates is not eating filet mignon 3 days a week, 7 days, you know, 3 times a day, 7 days a week. But yes, there is a substitution, and that is why, that's one of the reasons that the market for commodity beefs has gone, meats in general, has gone a bit haywire in the last roughly decade, because yes, the demand on the part of the Chinese is accelerating like crazy, in part, not just because they're becoming more affluent, but also because at the moment the Chinese government is engaged in a long-term project to systematically move farmers off the land into cities on the grounds that the country will benefit from having a bigger urban population, because then it can invest more in manufacturing and so on and so forth. The problem is Chinese agriculture is not even close to being equipped to feed a majority urban market. Right now, I think something like 40% of Chinese live in cities, and that's going to change very, very quickly over the next 5 years, and they have to modernize agriculture. That is why Shanghui bought Smithfield Foods earlier in 2013, which a sale, I don't know if your listeners were aware of it, but it caused a tremendous amount of controversy because critics feared that this Chinese company would start shipping bad meat, tainted meat, to the U.S., but that's not why it got bought. It got bought because the Chinese are trying to figure out how to feed themselves.
Do they have, will they have stricter regulations on what on meat than they do on some other items?
I'm not a Chinese expert, but I've been there twice, and so I tend to follow Chinese news. The Chinese government is attempting to create food safety regulations, but the problem in China is that the country, despite having a very, very centralized government, actually has a tremendous amount of decentralization when it comes to local rules and enforcement, meaning the translation is that it's almost impossible. Every day, if you look carefully, you can find yet another. This morning I read this story about how lamb producers in China pumped the carcasses full of filthy river water. Mm. Now, you know, so the Chinese government is trying to turn the page on stuff like that. And so, again, that's why Shanghui bought Smithfield. This is why Tyson, which is the largest poultry producer and one of the biggest pork producers in the world, is now investing billions of dollars in setting up chicken production farms in China, because it can transplant this model, this highly sanitary model with very, very good quality control, to China, where they desperately need it. The Chinese are absolutely interested in American agricultural technology because it's the only way they can get around these food safety issues, and it's the only way they're going to be able to feed that urban population.
We're speaking with Maureen Ogle, and the name of her latest book is In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. If you do want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org.
Maureen, there was a time in the 1960s, I believe, that it was considered more environmentally positive to have confined raising of animals. When did that change?
Yes. I'll just say at the outset, when I started the book, I knew absolutely nothing about any of this because I prefer to write books about things I don't know anything about. So I wasn't even aware of the controversy over confinement, let alone what confinement was. But as I started researching, I started paying more attention. And so the second half of the book looks at the origins of things like the use of antibiotics, the use of confinement, and so on and so forth. And yes, I was startled to discover that after the 1965, I believe, federal legislation for pollution control, as it was called at the time, now we would call it environmental legislation, states were charged, were given mandates. They had to start controlling water and soil pollution. And at the time, in the 1960s and 1970s, both state and federal governments, as well as environmental experts, believe that the best way to do that was to confine. That's not why confinement started, but became the motive for expanding livestock confinement as a way to control the pollutants that a farm actually produces. Obviously, if you tell that to somebody today, they think you're, you know, hallucinating or something, but it's true.
When did it become I lost my train of thought. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Well, let's talk about antibiotics. Tell us about the history of the and what your findings were about them.
Okay, here is and confinement and antibiotics are linked to each other, but
right.
not in the way that people think they are. The argument these days is that farmers only use antibiotics because they're using confinement. That isn't what happened historically. And again, I'm just a historian, so I'm just reporting the facts to people. As more Americans moved to cities, there were fewer and fewer farmers. And by the 1940s, when World War II broke out, the agricultural shortage was absolutely staggering. I was truly amazed. You know, that's why German prisoners of war were brought to the U.S., because farmers needed labor. So farmers did what Americans have been doing since they got here and faced labor shortage. They began to mechanize as much as they could. First, they mechanized feeding systems for their livestock. Then they began to bring those livestock inside, because to confine them was to eliminate the need for labor. That was the whole purpose of it to begin with. And as they began pondering confinement, they were also trying to figure out how to replace the protein boosts that commercial feed manufacturers had been adding to commercial feed for quite some time, primarily fish oil and cod liver oil, basically. Animals do best when they eat what's called animal protein, and in this case it had historically been things like fish oil, but those things disappeared when the Nazis and the Japanese launched war in the 1940s. So scientists were trying to figure out what is in animal protein factor so we can make a synthetic replacement. And through a long series of events, they quite by accident discovered that B12 was the relevant component of that animal protein factor, and that it was possible to manufacture it using the remnants of antibiotic manufacturers. So it wasn't that anybody set out to say, hey, let's use antibiotics. It just turned out that antibiotics were the vehicle for creating a very, very low-cost and extremely effective nutritional additive for livestock feed.
I remember my question now. When did people become conscious of animals as not just a commodity, but also beings, and feel kind of appalled by the slaughtering and that?
Well, there's humans' attitudes toward animals have been complex ever since human beings started recording their thoughts, and we can certainly trace the roots of animal rights and those kinds of things today. We could, you know, find the great-great-great-grandfathers of them back in the 18th century. But in the 1980s, as farmers' farms became much bigger and began to use things like confinement, one way that activists who opposed this latched onto a meat, you got to have a reason to oppose. And in the 1980s, one of those reasons was that this was inhumane treatment. Now, it didn't get much traction in the 1980s, but since the 1990s and on, and especially since the Humane Society of the United States decided, in effect, to adopt this cause as a fundraiser, now many more people are concerned about what happens on farms. So I wouldn't say the concern about livestock is new, but the form it takes now is relatively recent.
Are you implying that the Humane Society of the United States only adopted this in order to raise money?
I am implying that, yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. I will say, so you don't think I don't think I can get sued for slander or anything. I didn't know anything about any of this stuff, so I simply researched it and tracked the rise of groups that wanted to reform agriculture, the rural activists, I call them in the book, who eventually joined forces with urban hunger advocates so that town and country were linked. That's where the local food movement began back in the 70s. And from that has come a virtual industry of consumer advocacy and so-called public interest that is designed to promote a particular point of view, and that's obviously a good thing. In my opinion, based on what I read, yes, the Humane Society of the United States, it's a nonprofit. It needs to raise funds. So does Greenpeace. So does every nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to use various causes. And for the Humane Society, livestock production has become a gold mine because it's so easy to project horrible images or to, you know, have undercover agents go in and take videos of what allegedly happens on farms and so on and so forth. So I have to say, having read about this stuff and studied it and researched it, I'm a little bit cynical. It doesn't have anything to do with my politics. I'm just a little cynical about the nonprofit sector.
Hmm. Although the ability to put undercover people and film stuff is getting more and more difficult with these ad gag laws.
Yes, that is a really interesting issue. I'm sympathetic to both sides. I have a feeling that's going to be an issue that will probably eventually end up in the Supreme Court because it's very complicated.
We're speaking, we need to take another break, but I want to get back to this and this subject, if you don't mind, when we return. Okay. Maureen Ogle, and she's an historian. Her latest book is In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Let's take that break, and we'll be back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Maureen Ogle. She's an author and historian, and the book we're discussing today is In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. I just want to, last year we interviewed someone by the name of Jenny Brown. I don't know if you know her. She founded the Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary in upstate New York.
I've heard of the sanctuary, but I'm, yeah.
Well, she said she had a term for those who would rather not know about the meat and dairy industries. I believe it was something like willful ignorance.
Yes.
I'll stand corrected if I'm wrong, but it was to that effect. And how much a part of the inability or unwillingness to change this system do you think is on account of that phenomenon?
Oh, boy, how much time have we got? We got at least until midnight. let me just preface my response to that by saying that when I started working on this book about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months into the 7-year project, and it took me that long to do this book, I thought, I never really thought about it. I thought, the only way someone can eat meat is if they just don't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just can't think about it. And I have enormous respect for people who have decided to think about it. I did not eat meat for 25 years. I just started eating meat about, I don't know, 12 or 13 years ago. So I have enormous respect, and I would agree with what she says, although to that I would add this. Americans are less engaged in willful ignorance than they are in, again, I'm going to go back to where we started, to an extraordinary sense of entitlement. What I wrote about the meat industry could be said about any aspect of the food industry, from bread to ice cream to anything else. Americans really, really want what they want when it comes. We are the people who live in, you know, a great big well-stocked pantry, and it doesn't cost anybody very much to eat it. And that, of course, has become the crux of the matter. Critics of the current livestock production system, for example, argue that the meat appears to be low cost, but there are lots of hidden environmental costs, and mm-hmm. there are costs to our health. I don't disagree with that at all. My point about the willful ignorance is that as long as Americans continue to demand lots and lots of cheap food and meat whenever they want it, in any form that they want it, the system we have is probably not going to go away. It doesn't mean the system is a good one, but it means that it's really efficient at dealing with consumer demand. Now, how you go from 225 pounds to trying to persuade people to eat meat the way I do, I don't know how you do that. Maybe in 50 years we'll all look back and say, wow, those people in 2013 were really stupid, you know, because maybe in 50 years everybody will be eating 10 pounds of meat a year. But I agree. Willful ignorance is a great phrase. I don't know if she said it either, but it's good. It's very descriptive.
Why did you start eating meat again? If you don't...
Frankly, I felt really awful. I think I was not a great vegetarian. Part of it was I didn't have enough money to eat meat, and I got to the point where I could afford to eat more of what I wanted, but I also just wasn't feeling great, so I decided to start eating some meat. My husband and I both did, and we still eat just stupidly small amounts of meat, very, very little, 25 pounds a year each. but I just adding a little bit of meat to my diet made me feel physically a lot better. Sorry to say to all the vegetarians out there.
I was struck to find out that you say that the portion of the animal that's consumable, that winds up in the supermarkets, is actually that just kind of a break-even point for the meat producers, and to really make their profits off the rest of the animal, the carcass and skin. And
that's right. Particularly for, it's true for beef, only about, I don't know, roughly 55 or 60% of a full carcass is actually edible. But even of that part, Americans, because we're picky, will only eat very, very limited number of cuts. Americans don't like tongue. They usually don't like shin. There's a lot on every animal that Americans just don't want to eat. And there's a reason for hot dogs and sausage. I mean, that's one way that meat packers can use foodstuffs that are completely edible. There's nothing wrong with kidney, tongue, chin, anything else, except somehow we Americans have trained ourselves not to eat it. It's actually very, very hard to make a profit if you are in the business of making meat. It's tough.
I guess some of that winds up in dog food.
The only thing that ends up in dog food are the pieces that, for whatever reason, the federal rules don't allow to use, which includes things that might have, for example, this is just an example, bone fragments in it. You know, those are not supposed to. So if there's anything for a long time, does everybody remember the pink slime things here? I'm just interrupting.
Yeah.
Myself,
let's talk about the pink slime.
Okay. Well, there's a classic example of that whole episode absolutely fascinated me. I was almost finished with the book at the time, so I could just sort of stand back and enjoy it. Here's the deal with pink slime. Meat packers, particularly when it comes to packing beef, it is extremely difficult to earn a profit on the actual carcass. So meat packers are constantly trying to cut costs and find other ways to bring in revenue because they're not making it on that. And since the 1970s, meat packers have been using mechanical methods to try to scrape every bit of usable meat flesh off of a carcass in some way. You know, you don't want to leave any of that fillet there. You really don't want to leave it if you're a meat packer. And the FDA banned the method that was in use in the early 1980s, which involved very, very tiny knives that just chopped and chopped. And so deprived of this method, a lot of what had been going into hamburger started being used for dog food because there was no legal way to use it. Then an entrepreneur named Eldon Roth, who lived in, I think, Nebraska or else South Dakota, developed a way to use centrifugal force instead of blades to, in effect, spin off all of the usable meat from a carcass, but also eliminate and remove as much of the fat and gristle and tendon as possible. And he developed this process. He would buy carcasses from packers, spin them, and then pack the bits into these big cubes and then sell those to meat processors who used it in hamburger. In the 1980s, after the E. coli scare, Eldon Roth developed a way to just shoot the whole, the spun bits, to shoot them with a tiny blast of ammonia, which I might add is in meat naturally. It's, if you eat meat, you're eating ammonia. And he was very successful because he created a way to use every last bit of a beef carcass until 2012. Well, actually 2011, when Jamie Oliver, the celebrity chef, who had a short-lived American television show, ran a 5-minute segment about pink slime. Not one single thing in that 5-minute segment is accurate. It was a complete distortion of the process used to make this lean, finely textured beef known to the public as pink slime. And a blogger in Texas got a hold of the story when she found out the USDA was selling this stuff to school lunch programs, blah, blah, blah. Within 2 months, Eldon Roth had shut down all but one of his plants and all of his competitors had gone out of business. So that's the pink slime story. There was never anything dangerous about it.
And isn't there a pending lawsuit?
I think that there is a lawsuit, but I don't really think it's going to go anywhere. I gather various meat industry groups are planning to sue for defamation. I don't really think that's going to go too far. To me, the interesting thing was that here was a method of being frugal. Eldon Ross didn't do anything more than your average really, really good housekeeper would do in trying to use up leftover food. You know, I think only in a society like ours where we have so much and our food is so cheap will anybody turn their noses up at a way of reducing waste and lowering costs. And that's what Eldon Ross was doing, except he's not doing it anymore.
We're speaking with Maureen Ogle. She's an author and historian, and we're discussing her book, In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. One more short break, and we'll resume.
And we're back. Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and historian, and excuse me, author Maureen Ogle. We're talking about In Meat We Trust. Maureen, it's 1:46 here on the East Coast, so I guess most people are finished with their lunch, so maybe you can take us through this business of manure pools.
I could do that. Okay, well.
Maybe yeah. I shouldn't say business.
No. Well, in some sense, it is a business because there's been a lot of spin-off businesses from it. Again, part of the criticism, justifiable, of the contemporary form of livestock production in the United States is that it takes place in confinement. If you confine the animals, you're also confining their manure. And again, this is a development that began in the 1950s, primarily because of a labor shortage and rising land costs. Confining the manure, believe it or not, at first consisted of, for example, replacing these confinement floors with, instead of having a solid floor, just having a slotted floor so all the manure would fall down into a pit, and then, you know, occasionally kind of sucking it out of there or shoveling it out or whatever. But of course, as these livestock confinement operations got bigger and bigger, and they have gotten very, very big, it's not unusual to have a confinement operation with 20 or 25,000 animals. Well, I think we can all imagine what the consequences are. And, how exactly do you get rid of this? I mean, in some ways, it sort of defies science. What the heck do you do with all of it? Because soil itself can only take so much manure before you burn the soil. So especially since the 1980s, one entrepreneur after another has come up with a way to burn the stuff, turn it into fuel, turn it into whatever, but the fact remains, there it is. And if I've never been within, as to my knowledge, 5 miles of a confinement operation, but I gather I would know if I was.
Now, you live in Iowa.
I do live in Iowa.
And I understand that there's actually more pigs in Iowa than people.
Yes, that's true. It's also true in Denmark, by the way, just so everybody doesn't think we're weird. That's right. I mean, this is an agricultural state, although I will say I've always lived in a city, and to my knowledge, I've never even been on a farm. I mean, if I was, I was so young, I don't remember it. But yes, there are a lot of hogs here and a lot of confinement operations. And there have been controversies about them over the years. Again, I'm not, people seem to think that because I can explain this that I'm defending it, and I, you know, that's not what I do. I'm just a historian, and as long as demand stays what it is, it's not clear to me what the alternatives are. For example, critics of the system would like to eliminate all of confinement and all of these so-called corporate farms, but if you do that, we're going to need a great deal more land devoted to livestock production, a lot more, and we're going to need a lot more labor. I don't know where either one of those things are going to come from.
Is that what you mean when you say that you write unfair representations of meat are being made by people like Michael Pollan and Mark Bittman? Is that what you're saying they're getting wrong?
I think I have nothing but respect for Michael Pollan. There are some errors in his book, but he's not a historian. You know, when you're a historian and you notice that someone sort of fluffs the facts of history, you think, oh, come on, you could have done better. But he's not a historian.
And he's not anti-meat.
No, he's not anti-meat. He's not anti-meat. What I think the Pollanites, and I'm just using that term to describe a large, large group of people who've been influenced by his ideas and some of whom have long participated in efforts to try to end the use of confinement, the use of antibiotics, and so on, industrial farming. They want to end industrial farming.
Mm-hmm.
they do not offer a practical alternative. Their alternative is we're going to have small farms, we're going to graze animals naturally on pasture instead of confining them. And I keep asking them, where are you going to get the land to do this, and who do you think is going to do the labor? I'm not volunteering to go to the countryside. Those are very practical issues, and just because I raise them doesn't mean I'm defending the system. I'm just saying, if you don't want this system, you got to come up with a practical alternative that supplies 225 pounds of meat and the billions of pounds of meat that we ship abroad every year.
Well, realistically, from all your research, what facets of the industry do you think can be bettered, and how can it be more sustainable and environmentally conscious?
Well, when I have talked to farmers, and when I started digging around to find out what exactly are farmers doing, livestock producers, as a rule, are surprisingly ecological. They're trying to use their land the best way they can. They're trying to avoid polluting as best they can, which is why, you know, there's a real urgent need to figure out what to do, for example, with all that manure. Believe me, if someone could, you know, invent the perfect gadget, every farmer in America would adopt it. I can't get past the demand. Let's just say antibiotics are clearly going to get eliminated. Every farmer I've ever talked to says, yes, antibiotics will probably be gone in less than 5 years.
Okay.
And that's going to raise the cost of meat. It just will raise the cost of meat, period, because the mortality rate will rise among livestock, and animals will take longer to come to market, and farmers will therefore have to feed them more. So meat costs will go up. Now, that might be the trigger that finally, for the first time in American history, starts to reduce demand, because everything that agriculture has done for the last 400 years is try to reduce production costs and reduce the cost to the consumer. If we start backtracking on that, we could actually end up changing meat culture, and that's not a bad thing. But I think it would really have to take something very, very dramatic that would raise the cost of meat so high that the nature of demand in the United States after four centuries would finally change. That could push this all in a new direction.
Well, do you think the end of the use of antibiotics might do that?
Well, it's certainly going to raise cost of meat, of both beef and pork in particular. It will absolutely raise their cost. In the short term, there will probably be a decline in cost as farmers decide to unload their livestock and possibly get out of business. But over the long haul, as I say, livestock mortality rates will rise, and farmers will have to spend more on feed, and they are going to pass those costs on to the packers, who are then going to pass them on to consumers. Now, here's a good example. If you go to Whole Foods, I did a little investigative trip a couple of months ago. If you go to a place like Whole Foods and you look at the meat that is raised sustainably, environmentally, you know, the right kind of meat, the price is easily four times what it is for conventional meat. That is where we will be heading over time. And again, that could change demand. Everybody might start eating meat the way I do, and then we wouldn't need. Remember, we have the system we have to meet a very high level of demand. Change the demand, and you can change the system.
What do you hope to accomplish with In Meat We Trust?
Two things. One is, as I researched the book, and again, it took me 7 years. I spent a long time thinking and researching and writing this stuff. I became aware of this very, very intense debate about the American food system and about meat in particular. And I'm not startled anymore, but I'm a little dismayed at how much misinformation there is out there. So I'm hoping that the book will allow people to actually go into this discussion with a better context, with a better frame of reference that's historical in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And my second goal is, I'm a historian, and I would really like Americans to understand that, you know, doing history can be beneficial, and it can be a pleasure to read, I hope, anyway, and that history is really a vital part of our society.
You also have a blog, Maureen, right?
I do, yes, which has been a little slow of late because of things like this, but not that I'm complaining. Yet.
And your website is maureenogle.com, and that's O-G-L-E,
right.
And of course the first name is M-A-U-R-E-E-N. We have just one quick question here. I can't get to the whole email, but it was something I was wondering too. Robin asked, what about, and we only have like 20 seconds.
Okay.
Doesn't Argentina eat more than the U.S. per capita? More meat?
They produce a huge amount, but they don't. Actually, they do not, believe it or not. They're very high up there, but no.
Hmm.
It's Luxembourg and then the U.S., and then I think both Brazil and Argentina are, you know, up there somewhere in the top 10.
Well, we want to thank Maureen Ogle. Thanks so much for being with us. She's an author and historian, and this latest book is In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. We'll have links to the book on our website, WLRN.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much, both of you, for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We always have free audio archives and downloads of our programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information as well as links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is with Harvard-educated physician Dr. Melissa Clark. She tells how to take ownership of your health and make reforms work for you. And our calendar on this day, 1931, 83 years ago, the birth of author E.L. Doctorow in the Bronx, New York. Ragtime, World's Fair, Billy Bathgate, and The March. And today in 1978, 36 years ago, the death of insurance magnate and philanthropist John D. MacArthur, founder of Bankers Life and Casualty Company. Of course, he and his wife Catherine's foundation is a frequent public radio underwriter. One more while we ponder simulacra and hyperrealism. On this day in 1996, 18 years ago, the death of acclaimed South Florida-based sculptor Dwayne Hansen in Boca Raton. He's famous for those amazingly lifelike painted sculptures of average people, complete with hair and real clothes. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from E.L. Doctorow, who served in the Army of Occupation in Germany. Quote, "Riding is like driving at night in the fog. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you make the whole trip that way." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned now for Here and Now from NPR News.